Good afternoon, everyone. Thanks to Capital Link for putting this on, and also for Nicholas for his efforts to try and gee people up on this panel session. I believe the panel after lunch is colloquially known as the graveyard slot. We're all trying desperately not to be offended by that on the panel, and indeed it's sort of quite ironic because actually we're in a situation where we've got a really strong dry bulk sector, especially seasonally, where at a time when you'd expect dry bulk earnings to be weak, we're actually at very impressive levels. Rather than going down the line and introducing everyone individually, I'd like to mix it up and maybe just ask each panelist to introduce both themselves and very briefly their company and how they're playing these strong dry bulk markets. So maybe, John, if we could start off with you, please.
Yeah, sure. John Wobensmith, CEO of Genco Shipping and Trading. We are 100% dry bulk. We own 43 ships today on the water. We have 16 of those are our Capesize vessels, and then the remaining are midsize Ultramax and Supermax vessels. We have a very strong direct owner-operator commercial platform model, and then we also have our technical management based in India in Chennai. Capital allocation, which we believe is one of the most important pieces of running a shipping company, we have our value strategy where we have paid down our commercial bank debt down to about 9% on a net basis, and we believe in that very low leverage model to drive down your cash flow break even. We're at about a $9,000-$10,000 a day cash flow break even rate all in, and so that allows us to pay very healthy dividends, but also having the ability to grow as circumstances allow themselves. So how we're playing the dry bulk market. For the most part, we're spot right now. We have done some index deals that have been very helpful in the Capesize sector. I would say our minor bulk is really 100% spot, and there's a very robust commercial platform there where we are doing all sorts of cargo trades and trying to beat the indices. On the Capesize side now, when we're looking at 35,000 plus a day, we are starting to think about whether we want to selectively take some exposure off the table and lock in rates for a year to 18 months at this point. We think that's a smart thing. Again, with a $10,000 a day cash flow break even and you're looking at $35,000 a day on a Capesize vessel, seems to be the right thing to do to lock in some of it. That doesn't mean we're going to lock in the whole fleet. We still believe in this market in terms of moving upwards, but that's how we're playing it right now.
Thanks, John. Lars? John?
Yeah, hi. My name is Lars Christian Svensson. I'm the CEO of Golden Ocean. We are exposed to Capesizes and Panamax and Kamsarmaxes. Currently, we have 60 Capesizes and Newcastlemaxes and 35 Kamsarmaxes and Panamaxes. We also believe in a low cash break even. That adapts us in a way that we can take the commercial risk when we see a market spike, like for instance in Q1 where we went fully spot with our entire fleet to be able to capture that market. If you don't have a low cash break even in this instance, then you are not able to position a fleet that way. You don't want the high leverage on the cash break, high leverage on the financing and the operational risk at the same time. Currently, we think the market has more legs. We will probably run this cycle a little bit longer in the spot market and not take too much cover off at the moment. Our LTV currently stands at 37% in a high cycle scenario. In mid-cycle, we're aiming around 50%. We're quite comfortable with that exposure as of now.
Fantastic. Thanks. Steve?
Yeah, hi. I'm Steve Kunzer. I'm CEO of Lila Global, which is a private ship owner based in Dubai. We've got a fleet of 41 vessels, 17 Capes, 4 Campuses, 4 Supras, a couple of Ultras, and the rest are Handies. The balance is a mix of chemical tankers, MPP, and containers. Our fleet at the moment is currently mostly trading spot. We've got a few vessels on index and a couple of vessels on slightly longer term and TC. like the others, I think we believe that the market has got some legs, but there may be a bit of downside risk coming up.
Good afternoon. I'm Stavros Giftakis. I am the CFO of Synergy Maritime and United Maritime, two publicly listed companies listed both on NASDAQ. Synergy is the flagship company of the group, a pure play Capesize company. We own 16 Capesize vessels and one Newcastlemax vessel. United is a younger company which was spun out and listed on NASDAQ in 2022. To follow a more opportunistic kind of model. United completed its first investment cycle in 2022-23, investing in tankers, which we bought and sold very quickly, locking a very good profit for our shareholders. And then now it's undergoing its second investment cycle geared towards the larger gearless bulkers. United has three Capes, three Kamsarmaxes, and three Panamaxes. So, in total, 26 vessels, 26 bulkers in the two companies. We have relationships with some of the world's most well-known charterers, and all our time charters are based on index-linked rates. We do maintain options to convert index-linked rates to fixed, which we trigger from time to time when the FFA curve is in line with our return targets. Having said that, we think 2024 is shaping up to be a good year for dry bulk, so we're happy to maintain as much as possible on index-linked basis.
So, Hamish?
And hi, I'm Hamish Norton. I'm the president of Star Bulk Carriers Corp. We are a large, diversified dry bulk company. We have about equal values of Capesize, Panamax and Kamsarmax and Supermax and Ultramax ships. So by number of vessels, that's about 20% Cape and Newcastlemax, about 35% Panamax and Kamsarmax, and about 45% Supermax and Ultramax. We have about 115 ships. We have an announced merger agreement with Eagle Bulk Shipping, which will be closing in early April, which is a Supermax and Ultramax company that has ships with basically scrubbers across the whole fleet, which generate substantially more revenue than ships without scrubbers. We have scrubbers on our whole fleet, so the fleets match very well. We, as some of the other shipping companies on the table believe in keeping our leverage relatively low, our break-even relatively low, and we have a dividend policy that calls for us to pay basically all of the cash on our balance sheet over a reserve level, which was set by our board at $2.1 million per owned ship. And so as a result, basically every quarter we pay out our operating cash flow after debt service, which is, you know, can be quite a large dividend. And we think the advantage of the formula is that analysts can project the dividend level. That is basically the story.
Ted? Thank you, Hamish. My name is Ted Petrone. I'm the vice chairman of Navios Maritime Partners. We are a public company. We've been around, well, not in public, but we started as U.S. Steel many years ago. 70 years, I think we call ourselves a 19-year startup. We have 176 vessel diversified fleet, 77 are dry, 35 Capes, 37 Panamaxes, 5 Supras. We like to play the time charter market in terms of short to medium to long term according to where we are in the cycle. And I think we're getting to the point where many people are that, you're getting a lot of calls for long term periods. So it looks like all of us not only owners but charters are seeing the same numbers going forward in terms of the order book and the overage and the IMO regulations. Because of a diversified fleet and the play we made in the container side with circa $3 billion in revenue, our open day break-even is de minimis today.
Super. Thanks, Ted. So before my current position, I spent 15 years as a market analyst, typically trying to forecast the markets and not always getting them right. But one of the key takeaways was around the order book. That's the bit you've got actually good visibility on. What does the supply side look like? And I think we've already touched on it. The dry bulk order book is pretty low by historical standards. So I'm keen both to hear the panel's views on the order book, but also one of the reasons that sort of kept the order book low, I guess, is the difficulty of knowing what to order. The fuel selection, the technologies you put in a ship, that wider piece. So also really keen to hear thoughts around sort of what a least regrets order today looks like, how can you position yourself to make sure that the vessel you order is not going to be one you regret in sort of 10-15 years time. Maybe to mix things up a little bit, Lars, could you kick off on that?
Yeah, thank you. Over the last 3 years, we increased the fleet size with 30%. So we're in a situation in Golden Ocean where we don't have to do anything at the moment. We have 95 ships, average age of 7 years, and we're always looking for accretive deals to increase the company value, but it's very difficult to know what to order at the moment. People can have opinions about methanol, ammonia, dual fuel, LNG, and LPG, but I think we need all these technologies to be able to reach the common goal by 2050. At the same time, the older ladies that we have in our fleet, we are very much able to make them more efficient. When you have a ship in dry dock nowadays, you can use low-friction paint, you can put on Mavic ducts, Boscap fins, all-electronic sensor, ultrasound on the propeller, all these things to make sure that your vessel is more than capable of reaching the IMO standards. So together as an industry, it's interesting to look at the order book. We are on the Capesize sector. We are less than 6% now, which is a 30-year low. So for the first time, and as far as I've been in this industry, we have a clear visibility on the supply side for the ships. That means, which we are very good at in this industry, when things look good, we build the market to death. But this time around, thank God for the container ships and the LNG ships and the tanker ships that are already in the slots, it's very difficult to find dry cargo slots, especially for the larger sizes, with delivery prior to 2027-28. That gives us a very good comfort, and it also gives us a comfort when we see structural trends like we have now, in the, especially for Capesizes, with the new bauxite that came up 3 years ago with great volumes. Let's go 5 years back, then we had the only way you could fix a ship if you ballasted past the Cape of Good Hope, which you normally do with Capesizes, was to Brazil. 3 years ago, bauxite volumes picked up in the Capesize segment, and all of a sudden you can make a right around Cape of Good Hope and you can go to West Africa. That was our predicament when we went into Q1. We saw strong cargo volumes that tilted the ships in the spot market. And then we had the Suez debacle going on, which means that you couldn't get any more ships into the Atlantic that way either. So now when you have a ship around Cape of Good Hope, you can go right to West Africa, straight to Brazil, and now even Colombian coal and U.S. East Coast coal come up. This is very good for ton miles, which is why we had a massive push in the Capesize segment so far this year. We think this is going to last a little bit going forward, and that's why we continue with the spot strategy. Thank you.
Yeah. No, I'd love to come back to some of those points around the demand side and the shifts there. I'd like to throw it open to the panel, actually, and say, does anyone else have a view on around the order book, and particularly how you can choose if you're looking to order a ship in the coming 3-4 years, let's say, how you can try and lock in some level of optionality or redundancy in that vessel to ensure that, you know, it's going to be able to keep trading?
I mean, you know, we have not been ordering substantial numbers of ships recently. We placed an order for 5 ships that use basically traditional fuel oil but have very, very low fuel consumption, very high efficiency ships. with the latest electronically controlled engines from MAN, with shaft generators that allow you to run the ship without the auxiliary generators powered up. But in 3 or 4 years, I think it will probably be time to be ordering ships that are able to be zero carbon ships. It's very hard to know precisely what technologies you'll need now, and maybe we won't know for sure in 3 or 4 years, but what is clear is that if you wait until it's absolutely obvious, it's too late. You know, shipping companies are going to have to order ships for the era of decarbonization before they really know for sure what they need to order. So there are going to be some substantial risks. You know, we took such a risk in 2019 when we decided to equip our whole fleet with scrubbers, and we spent about $250 million that we didn't have, and we paid it all off in 2.5 years. And hopefully we can do something like that again. That would be good.
Yeah, but, you know, it's interesting. Hamish brings up a great point. A couple things. One, 75% of the ships that have been ordered in the last 6 to 8 months in dry bulk have been conventional fueled ships, which is really surprising to me. We have not done any new builds. We obviously believe that going forward a lot needs to be done. But when you start looking at the numbers, Hamish, you've started to bring this up. You've got 12,000 dry bulk vessels out there, 8,000 tankers maybe, container ships still that need to be placed. There just isn't enough room to build these in over the time period of getting, you know, in my view, of getting to where we need to be by 2030, 2040, and then ultimately 2050. So I think that this industry is going to have one hell of a challenge in terms of renewing fleet for alternative fuels. And obviously the problem right now is we don't know exactly what that fuel is going to be. Is it going to be methanol? Is it going to be ammonia? There are obviously challenges, plus and minuses, to both of those. So to me, I think that's one of the biggest challenges the industry is facing right now is how do you build all this in that period of time that we've committed to?
You know, so if I may add, I mean, technological uncertainty is one thing, but this has not prevented the tanker companies and the container companies from ordering ships. Yep. The fundamental difference here when it comes to dry bulk vessels, and especially the largest one, is that financially it doesn't make sense. I mean, when you have new building Capesizes at 2 times the price of a second-hand, of a 10-year vessel, and then the premium that you get over the index isn't that fantastic, I mean, that drastic to justify the investment. At the same time, you have charterers who are not willing to commit to longer periods at fixed rates, which make some sense in terms of returns. Something's got to give. And it's years and years of under-ordering in the dry bulk sector that eventually we will catch up with what's happening on the demand side. So we do see, as John said earlier, some tendency lately, charterers providing some better numbers for 12, 18 months. But I think looking at what you said, the least regret option would be to find consensus with the charterers on a specific vessel design, whereby they would be willing to give you 5 to 7 years charters at fixed rates, at meaningful fixed rates, whereby you can amortize most of your investment and take an educated approach on the residual risk. And until that time, I don't see the what's happening in the order book changing.
It's going to be interesting to follow going forward as well. I mean, coming into 2029, 40% of the Capesize fleet is more than 15 years old. As we all know, most of the Australian miners, et cetera, they have a 15-year-old age limit to all the ships that they can take. So something has to give.
Yeah. I mean, I agree with Stavros. I mean, we're a buyer of second-hand ships, but we're not certainly not buying new buildings at the moment until we see more clarity on fuels and until we can see charters are willing to pay for it. They're not willing to pay for it at the moment.
Maybe let's go there then, actually, and take a slightly different direction and talk about the charters. Fully agree. Over over at least the years I've been in shipping, there have been conversations with charters. They've listed out their requirements. The questions always come, are you willing to pay for it? They've said yes, definitely, and then you've actually tried to negotiate something with them, and it's just never really happened. I guess I've seen a little bit of a change in the last sort of year or two. We've done within Lloyd's Register projects with three of the five largest mining companies about how they can decarbonise their fleets, work with a number of the larger trading houses in Geneva, the ABCDs of this world, again around decarbonisation. I think probably those projects wouldn't have taken place even 5 years ago. So I'd be interested to hear the panel's views on whether we think those opinions are changing. And maybe Ted, could we start with you, given you have slightly...
I just want to remind you that the joint venture we did with you, Lloyd's Register and the five shipping companies, the Greek shipping companies, we control about 600 ships. Here's the problem. Decarbonization, okay, methanol, there's a problem with the slip, not well to wake, but well to tank. Ammonia, I'm not getting on the ship if I'm a crew member. So there's a whole bunch of issues. But what we decided to do through the joint venture with Lloyd's Register and the others is go after the ships that are in the fleet. And to John's point before about how many ships are out there, containers dry and wet, 10,000 dead weight and above, forget to you, I'm talking dead weight, but it's about 27,000 ships, 2,500 new buildings, so 8%. Those ships are more modern. They've got a smaller carbon footprint. The ships in the water... We're going to have to, it's been a defragmented effort, as it usually is in dry around the world, to attack any particular problem. So we wanted, with Lloyd's Register and the other Greek ship owners, to start a hub, a decarbonization hub in Piraeus. Maybe there's one in the States, maybe there's going to be one in Singapore, so we can attack this problem. You know, like as you slow down the ships, maybe you have to change the shape of the bulbous bow, you have to change the paint, you need a smaller propeller. There's a whole bunch of other issues, energy-saving devices. We can get to 30% by 2030 without the new fuel, I think is possible. But that next leap, 70%, we have to find the new fuel.
Yeah, but the structure of just how the dry bulk industry works is problematic in itself. So, yes, you've got the Rio Tintos, you've got the BHPs of the world that you can focus with and partner with. But one of the biggest thing I think this industry lacks is collaboration in general. And unfortunately, yes, iron ore is a very big part of dry bulk shipping, but there's also coal, there's grains, there's cement, there's wood products, there's gypsum. It runs the gamut. It's very fragmented. So it's great, and you can go do a deal with Rio or BHP on the iron ore front, and obviously that's how we've always thought it was going to start. That is happening. But to get the rest, the mid-size and the smaller charters that are a major, major part of this industry together to do something with owners and as someone brought up, willing to pay for it, that's where the challenge lies. And that's as an industry, we need to come together on that.
Yeah. I think one of the big problems in the dry bulk industry as far as decarbonization goes is that... By contrast, container lines have customers that have a major retail presence. Car carriers have customers that have a major retail presence. Even oil tankers have customers that have a major retail presence. Dry bulk charterers do not deal with retail, with very few exceptions. So as a reputational matter, decarbonization is not that important to the charterers of dry bulk ships. And so basically what we need is regulation in order to drive decarbonization. Just to get at the point of cooperation, in a dry bulk charter, you have a time charter description, which would give the promised fuel consumption at a couple of speeds. And, then if the charterer thinks you haven't met those relatively discrete promises, you can have a speed claim. In terms of optimizing the route and the speed, which you need a full sort of analysis of the ship's performance to do, no dry bulk company is prepared to give that information out. Yeah. You know, so it's it will be a while.
Yeah. I wouldn't rule out carbon capture. The major oil companies in the States are putting a lot of money behind it. Like in a horse race, it's probably third coming around the rail or fourth, but I think it's in a good position because there's a lot of, I mean, right now you're only getting 20%, right? If you do LNG, you're down 20% and then do carbon capture. You're not going to get, you know, you just can't get to what we need to do by 2050, the net zero, unless we have a new fuel. But, you know, a couple of, whatever it is, you need a double leap in technology going forward to get to that. And carbon capture might be that. It's one of many solutions.
Yeah. Yeah, of course, carbon capture, unlike saving fuel, carbon capture doesn't have a financial payback until you have a carbon tax.
Well, that's coming. Yeah. We were just meeting with the Coast Guard and IMO yeah. and D.C., and, you know, we were talking about the European ETS, and listen, the IMO, it's coming. It's going to come worldwide. If it's not this year or next year, it's going to be a couple of years from now, but you're right, Hamish, you're right.
Yeah. Oh.
As a company, we have been advocating the importance of cooperation between charters and owners on these energy efficiency improvement projects for many years now. It was actually in this same forum back in 2018 that our CEO, together with the head of sustainability of Cargill, presented the first project whereby we piloted energy-saving devices together with Cargill in one of our Capesize vessels. Back then, there was a little to no interest from other charterers to uptake similar projects, but lately we see even the less sensitive, as Hamish mentioned before, even the less sensitive charterers showing some interest to participate in one form or the other. And even if they do not commit to cover part of the cost, I mean, you can always recharter the vessel at improved speed descriptions, and then you will get part of your investment back and maybe some return if you're lucky. But every little steps count to where we are today.
Yeah, as you say, it's a question of taking small steps. So by installing energy efficiency devices, charterers are more willing to take your vessel and pay a little bit more for it. But it comes in small steps, you know, a couple of percentage here and a couple of percentage there. But we have to do all we can to make our older vessels on non-new buildings, more sustainable.
Exactly, and it's also about transparency. For example, with NYK, when we did a similar project, they were not persuaded about the improvement in the performance of the ship. We monitored the performance for 6 months after the installation of the energy-saving devices, and then they agreed to apply a premium retrospectively from when the energy-saving devices were applied. So it doesn't hurt to be transparent. It doesn't hurt to try to cooperate.
No, we have the same experience here. We have people who are willing to backdate their payments because once the energy efficiency devices have been proven. So.
Let me maybe sort of dig into energy-saving devices a little bit more then. And sort of, I think, Lars, you were the first to mention the performance of energy-saving devices. I mean, how do you see, as a sort of a company with a fiduciary duty to your shareholders, how do you see fitting energy-saving devices off your own balance sheet that will save ultimately save the charterers money? How big are you willing to go? Would you spend $500,000 on, you know, a wind assistance without a charter commitment? How do you think about that sort of investment decision?
No, we think that we're more than happy to spend money on these vessels in dry dock. I also think the more money you spend on the vessels, that means that the vessel will perform better, spend less fuel, which means that the bottom line will be even bigger. So the payback time you get on these energy efficiency devices tend to be quite good. We have a premium fleet to the prevailing indices because the indices are dated quite a while back, like I think the rest of the panel here has as well. So right now, we're trading, the last 2 years, we traded at over $4,000 premium to that index on a weighted average between the Capes and the Panamaxes. With more money spent on vessels in dry dock to optimize the speed consumption, thus also reducing your carbon, that premium will go from 4 to 5 to 6 over time. So to spend some more money on it in dry dock, you're going to get it back on the bottom line.
Yeah. I think one shouldn't minimize the importance of operating the ships, not necessarily in the time charter market. You know, at the moment we operate our Capes and Newcastlemax is in the voyage charter market, and therefore we get directly the benefit of fuel savings. Historically, we've operated our Supermaxes in the time charter market, but that's going to change when we integrate the quite sophisticated chartering operation at Eagle. That should get us directly the fuel savings. And so, I completely agree with Lars. You know, if you spend money intelligently in dry dock on the appropriate paints, appropriate, for example, duct work near the propeller, and you pay attention to keeping the hull clean, which is probably the single most important way to save fuel. You know, if you have a dry bulk ship that spends 30 days in a warm water port, you can get a hull fouling that costs you 20% of your fuel consumption easily. Energy saving devices, keeping the hull clean, route and speed optimization are all very important.
Yeah. John, can you talk us through Genco and what... How you're thinking about energy saving devices, what work you've done already, and
yeah, so I, like most people on the panel, we've put energy saving devices on almost the entire fleet right now. We started with the Capes for obvious reasons. You get more bang for your buck, but as Lars said, it's about a payback. It's about a return. We're not trying to save charterers money. We're trying to save ourselves money, which is what happens when you're burning less fuel. Fuel is the most. It's the largest expense on our income statement. So it drops straight to the bottom line as you are able to improve fuel efficiency by 5-7% with ESDs. And yeah, it's a. Might even be less than a two-year payback, depending on where the price of fuel is. That's the other great thing. The higher the price of fuel goes, the faster the payback is. Look, it's an intermediate step. We've also been doing a lot of fleet renewal, where we're trading, selling our older assets, less efficient, and we're buying newer eco-type assets, particularly in the Capes. And we're starting to do some of that now in the mid-size sector in the 58. So it's a combination. And obviously, just like everyone else, we continue to look at what do we want to do down the road in terms of new buildings and alternative fuel.
Yeah. I think there's going to be a real, well, in every situation, there's this mating dance that goes on between the owners and the charterers. And this is one that's going to play out where if the order book stays dampened, limited somewhat by the IMO regulations, you're going to get to where you are on the tanker side, where you have charterers coming to you to do, 5 and 7 year deals at well over 20 year averages. Then the discussion can begin in terms of energy saving devices that they need to also take part of, because a long term charter is a joint venture.
Yeah, for sure.
And also, as much as you invest on your ships, you extend their useful economic life, and then you postpone new building projects into the future, which are very heavy and intense in terms of CO2 emissions. So that's also another benefit which shouldn't be neglected. So provided you have a solid basis, and usually Japanese and Korean ships provide solid basis, very less so Chinese vessels built before 2015, so you can invest and extend the useful economic life of the ship, and that's to the benefit of everyone.
Yeah, no, for sure. I guess, and it'd be good, to talk a little bit more about the older ships. I mean, and maybe Steve, I can ask this to you. You've got a mixed fleet. You've actually got some very young ships, or some young ships, some middle-aged ships, but also some older vessels as well. Can you talk a little bit about what your options are when you get down to that sort of older tonnage in terms of ensuring compliance, what sort of measures you have to take, and also how you think the IMOs will be actually enforcing compliance mechanisms?
Yeah, thank you. So, yeah, as you rightly said, we have a mixed fleet in terms of age. We have some older vessels and some more modern ones. So, firstly, safety of vessel and crew is paramount. We don't operate anything which we think shouldn't be done. We're constantly looking from a technical viewpoint to make sure that they're 100% maintained. So we have very little downtime on these ships, very little off hour, very little loss of revenue. Yes, on the older ships, they're traded more in the spot market. Again, mainly we put them on voyage. We're a big believer in sustainability, so we're constantly looking to try and improve the performance of the vessels. We've got a number of dry docks coming up this year, so we've been installing more energy efficiency devices on those vessels that don't have them, for the reason we talked about earlier. So we're constantly fixing them well. Obviously, on the older Capes, we don't fix with the Australians, we don't fix with BHP and Rio Tinto. But as Lars said, we go down to Richards Bay and we turn right or we go straight on. we're doing a lot of that sort of business. We do a lot of business into India as well. So, yeah.
Yeah, no.
That answers your question, I was.
I think it's very, very helpful. I mean, just to give us an idea, though, as the owner it's a mixed fleet. But can you talk us through a little bit around what's going to be the driver for the decision to eventually sell or scrap an older vessel? Is that a decision that will be solely dictated by compliance, or is the market also going to play? How big a role is the market going to play in that?
Yes, compliance. Yes, because we have to be. We are in compliance of everything. Yeah. We get to a stage where you look at the vessel. We know each individual vessel. Each individual vessel is looked at like a project. Mm. So and all vessels, as everybody knows, are different. Some are made well. Some are made not so well. So if we get to a stage where we think the vessel should be scrapped, then we send it for recycling.
Yeah. It's economic, right?
Yes.
And so, again, older ships, they're higher dry docking bills. They're more frequent. You're burning more fuel. You're spending more on that. There are obviously charters that have regulations around this. But in the end of the day, I still think it comes down to a carbon tax. Those ships are going to be taxed more, so it's going to make it even more expensive to run older ships, and eventually that will force the recycling that ultimately needs to happen.
Yeah, I mean, we will move up the curve in terms of what we have.
We've got to level the playing field here a little bit between, whether it's alternative fuel versus, high-spec conventional versus, lower efficiency on the older ships. The field's got to be leveled, and the only way to do that is really through the IMO, and it has to be a global system. These regional, ETS is great, but in the end of the day, it's got to be more of a it's got to be a global phenomenon.
Yeah. And some of the secrets we keep is that the real answer today is slow the ship down. I mean, that's the biggest way to bring down your carbon footprint. And we have to rejigger CII. It needs to be recalculated. It's something that we need to change. It's not an accurate measurement, and I think the IMO is already in process of rethinking it.
Yeah, but I mean, you could completely throw CII away and never have it come back if you orchestrated, a proper IMO
tax.
Exactly.
On carbon.
Yeah.
On the point of older ships, I agree that carbon tax is likely to push these older ships out of the market, but I'm watching very carefully the technology around kites. Because wind-assisted ship propulsion is very expensive and doesn't actually contribute that much to fuel savings. But if you can get up high where there's a reliable wind with a kite system, and none of the kite systems that I know of work reliably yet, but there are people working on them very hard, you could, with some of these systems, pull a ship at 10 knots without the engine on. And, if that becomes perfected, you may not see these ships being scrapped that much. You know, scrapping a ship is a little like putting down the family dog. You do it when there's no hope. And, if there's hope, you know, you may see these ships hanging around and being pretty efficient.
The family dog?
And we wonder why the shipping industry's had challenges with oversupply over the last 20 years. I think just we're coming towards the end of the panel, and maybe we've already started touching a little bit on what we'd hope to see from the IMO, and I do think this is sort of really important for the ship owners to have a voice in this. So if I may, I'd like to just go down the line and say, if you had one regulation that you wanted to take from the IMO to try and decarbonise the shipping industry, what would that be? Would it be fixing CII, replacing it with EEOI? Would it be a global fuel standard? Would it be just a flat IMO carbon tax? Would it be some kind of a fee-bait thing where you have ships that burn conventional fuel pay taxes, and those taxes support, or those levies support green fuels? Keen, if we had to choose one measure, what do you think would be the most effective? And maybe could we start from the far end? So, Ted, if you could give us your...
Yeah, I don't... There's no magic wand, but I go back to... some of us were down in D.C. talking to the Coast Guard. We're founding members of NMEMPA. We're involved in HELMEMPA, and these are, organizations to try to keep this carbon out of the atmosphere. And I think we need to collaborate with the Coast Guard and the IMO, and they're looking for our feedback. And I think we got into a room, we had some great discussions about many things, and it was a real eye-opener for me because I hadn't done that in a long time with the technical people that were there. And I think it's good if senior management gets down there. They're looking to talk to us, they're looking for ideas, and our voice is actually being heard down in D.C.
From my point of view, if you don't have an enforceable carbon tax, decarbonization is going to take somewhere between a long time and forever. Whereas an enforceable carbon tax will get it done very quickly.
So CII, may not be optimal, but I like the fact that it incentivizes cooperation between owners and charterers to reduce idle time and to slow steam, which is always good and it's benefiting the industry. But if I had to go with one of the ones that you mentioned, I would go with a fee bait, like a carrot and a stick combined, because it's always useful for people that are doing more to get rewarded and people that are doing less to get penalized.
Yeah.
Steve?
I'm of the view that to supercharge decarbonization, you need a global carbon tax.
I think you need a bit of everything. I don't think it's done overnight. I think the stricter the regulations for us in Golden Ocean, the better it is. That means that we, with our modern fleet, we can do business that our competitors can't because they have a 10 or 15 or 20-year-old fleet. So bring it on.
Yeah, I agree with Lars. I think regulations, we thrive in that environment. We think we can, do better than most out there in that type. But I also think it's a little more of a holistic approach. CII, that I think should just absolutely go away. I mean, it was actually amazing. We were calculating, what the Red Sea meant for a ship on CII. And guess what? Going around the Cape of Africa, it's a better calculation, which makes no sense because we're obviously putting more carbon into the air in absolute terms. But the calculation turns out to be better. So I think it's a stage. I think it's a global carbon tax, but then ultimately a fuel standard. That's where I think we wind up. And the other thing that has to happen is, first movers in shipping generally don't do that well. And so we've got to set this up so that the first movers and the second movers can thrive going forward.
Yeah, I think that's a really good note to end on. I think also, it's also encouraging. I agree with you that supporting the first movers through some kind of a pooling mechanism probably is going to be pretty important because, as you say, it's not always been a good place to be in shipping. With that, we're at time. I personally think it's been fascinating. I really enjoyed moderating this, so thank you very much, gentlemen, for your time and your thoughts.
Thank you.
Thank you.